Ba-ba-ba-boo, if I could sing like Bing, how happy I would be. Ba-ba-ba-boo, ba-ba-ba-boo.
When Dean Martin paid his tribute to Bing Crosby back in 1953, it acknowledged the supremacy of the old groaner, the greatest crooner of them all. With unrivalled popularity on the silver screen and radio, most authorities still reckon that Crosby remains the man with the most number one singles, the most singles to hit the charts, and in White Christmas, the most popular song of all time.
Of a white Christmas, just like the ones I used to know.
People today, they're very impressed with the statistics, you know, how many hits he had, and more than the Beatles, and more than, you know, the hell with that. I wish that those people would go back and actually listen to some of the recordings. I think they'll be very surprised at how much he continues to communicate.
Many wonderful artists followed him, Sinatra and so forth, but he was the first to do it that way.
You would think that the next singer after Crosby would sound just like him and then some, or would be pushing towards the future, but instead they sound like something that came before Crosby rather than after him. And that's how radical that statement that Crosby was making was.
He really did change the course of music.
May your days be merry and bright, and may all your Christmases be white.
For all the soft tones and laid-back image, Bing Crosby was a revolutionary. He was born in 1903, and the 20s environment in which he began his professional life was right at the cusp of cultural change. It was the climax of the vaudeville era. Motion pictures were beginning to take off, and the new technologies of recording and broadcasting were making real inroads into people's lives. Electrical recording was ousting acoustic methods, and this in particular was a monumental development, particularly for singers, who'd been required to project their voices into acoustic horns as if they were trying to reach the far corners of a large auditorium. Singing softly and sweetly into a microphone allowed vocalists like Gene Austin to be intimate, close up and personal for the first time.
Blackbird, blackbird, singing the blues all day, right outside of my door. Blackbird, blackbird, why do you sit and say, there's no sunshine in store?
Will Friedwald is a writer on jazz singers.
Austin really was one of the very first to take advantage of the new recording technology. He starts recording around the very, very end of the acoustic era. When electricity is invented, that's when his career starts to pick up speed. And he really is just about the first major star to realize the possibilities of the microphone, that you could sing soft and intimately and you didn't have to belt. An obvious point of comparison would be Al Jolson, who was, you know, he was many things and he was wonderful and he was a brilliant musician. But one thing he never really was intimate. And Gene Austin was just the opposite. He was soft and he had a very sweet tenor voice. And he's also one of the very first to take advantage of the economic, technological situation in the sense that he was a monster seller. I mean, his records sold in the zillions. Even Crosby, at sort of the height of the 1930s, didn't really have million sellers the way Austin did.
All the singers had to embrace the microphone.
Singer and guitarist Spats Langham.
And what happens is that the singers are realizing they didn't have to belt it out. One of my absolute favorites was Whispering Jack Smith. Whispering Jack Smith, who was known as the Whispering Baritone. He was gassed in the First World War in the trenches, and he said that was why he sang in a whispering tone.
It's wonderful, it's marvelous that you should care for me. It's awful nice, it's paradise, it's what I love to hear. You've made my life so glamorous, you can't pay me for
It's absolutely beautiful, his delivery. Very soft, and you think of a year before the singers were belting it out.
This is a very particular aspect of using the microphone, which is actually confiding in it in a way that if he'd used more voice, he couldn't have done successfully.
That's right. If you take Rudy Valli's approach to singing, which is a megaphone style of approach, they used to sing down megaphones to get more volume, and also use them still in the recording studio. So, okay, here's Whispering Jack Smith. So he goes, whispering while I cuddle near you. So he sang like that. And then Rudy Valli would go, whispering while I cuddle near you. So he's got the megaphone sound, you see. But Whispering Jack Smith did have a warmth about his delivery in the same way as Al Boley did.
Loving the sweetest thing, what else on earth could ever be? Such happiness to everything that love knows for.
The pianist and bandleader Keith Nichols is also lecturer in early jazz at the Royal Academy of Music.
If you look at Al Boley, you know, that people call him the English Crosby. Not, he was quite different in style, but he makes love to the microphone.
Now, we know from the very early recordings that people like Louis Armstrong did that he was so forceful in the acoustic days that he was stuck somewhere back near the door of the studio while the rest of the band were clustered a little closer to the horn. I suppose the singer must have been relatively close in acoustic recording times.
Yes. The older style, which was the ragtime style, rather an ungainly way of singing. When the midnight choo-choo leaves from Alabama. There was great sort of dips and upwards and downwards, and rolling of the R's and through the nose, especially in Britain. That was the legacy from music hall style. And if you're going to put a label to crooning, it is the vocal featured style, solo male vocal with fairly large orchestra or a hot dance band, with a singer with not a tenor voice, but a light baritone voice.
Bing Crosby made his entry into the music profession as part of a duo with his teenage singing partner, Al Rinker. Rinker's older sister, the singer Mildred Bailey, introduced the boys to the great bandleader Paul Whiteman. And it was Whiteman who added the composer-singer Harry Barris to their number, and they became the Rhythm Boys.
We ain't got a barrel of mama money. Maybe we're ragged and fun funny. We'll travel along, singing a song, side by side. Don't know what's coming tomorrow. Maybe it's trouble and sorrow. We'll travel the road, sharing our load, side by side.
Gary Giddens is Bing's biographer.
From the moment Bing and Al Rinker got auditions, they always got the job. I find this sort of fascinating because we don't really know what they sounded like. We can only sort of guess what they sounded like before the Rhythm Boys. It doesn't sound like that much. And yet this was what got Whiteman's attention. And every time they auditioned for a vaudeville show, they got hired. So they must have had an enormous amount of charm and sparkle and grace on stage.
I suppose there's a bit of a clue to that. And that's in that record they made of Louise, where it's not just a song, but it begins with the whole stage business of the telephone call coming.
That's right.
Hello? Just a moment. You want to speak to Bing? Oh, we're making a record. All right.
One who could be calling me when I'm recording. Hello, hello. Who is this? Louise? Oh, well, that's different.
It's wonderful. Say it's wonderful to be in love with you. Beautiful. You're so beautiful. You haunt me all day through.
What do you say we help him out with the chorus, shall we?
All right.
Do you think they used that kind of vaudeville shtick more in reality than they did on record?
Oh, there's no question about that. And in fact, they got into quite a bit of trouble with a couple of stage managers who felt that they weren't getting their money's worth because they were doing too much shtick on stage and not enough singing. And I think Whiteman himself complained about it at that one point. But, you know, I think Crosby was trying things out. He had a sort of natural talent as a comedian, and he was very fast on his feet. And mostly I think they were having a lot of fun. And then, of course, you can't underestimate the power of alcohol at that time, because, Prohibition sort of like dared you to drink. And they went at it, and I'm sure they overdid it. I'm sure some of that also encouraged them to just try things on stage. They had a lot of nerve in that respect. I mean, I love the fact that they go to hear the Whiteman Orchestra and fall in love with the song in a Spanish town. They make it part of their act. And, of course, that's a number associated with Whiteman singer Jack Fulton, and he just about went through the roof when they dared to perform it before Fulton came out to do it.
Hello. Hold the wire just a minute, Louise. The boys are getting a bit frantic. Don't think the song should be sung like that. Now, that's awfully hot, but you should not interrupt my bliss when I'm singing to my sweetheart true. It should be sung like this.
Paul Whiteman was a band leader who famously recruited a sort of rogues gallery of some of the finest jazz players of the era, and then rather cruelly prevented them from playing much jazz once they got into the orchestra. There were huge arrangements which featured little vignettes for people like Jimmy Dorsey on reeds and Bix Beiderbecke on cornet, Eddie Lang on guitar. These very famous session musicians got little moments to appear. And in some ways it seems to me that there was a closer relationship between Bing and these star soloists than the rest of the sound of the band.
I think they were all mates because they were recruited by Whiteman. They were bought by Whiteman, and they were real soulmates with him because he had such a great gift for jazz. There was a payment hierarchy, you know, that in the Whiteman Orchestra, the longer you'd been in the band, the more money you got. If you did any specialities like comedy, you were paid a fortune. The jazz musicians were paid a certain rate, all of them the same, which is a sort of medium fee, but the lowest, only a little way up from the van driver and gophers, were the singers. I think it was like $120 a week, you know, it was the lowest rate poor old Bing got.
When he was playing with Paul Whiteman, you had to be a musician. You couldn't simply be a singer. It wasn't allowed. The musicians' union wouldn't allow it. So he was given a violin with rubber strings to play. And he would sit there and upstage all the real musicians who were actually playing music while he was sawing away at this violin with rubber strings that made no sound.
Bing's daughter, Mary Crosby.
His style, his choices were completely different from anybody else's. The Rudy Valley and the Al Jolsons and all these sort of weird artificial falsetto. He absolutely focused on the lyrics and on what the story of the song was, and he told it in a way that people could actually hear what he was saying. So the microphone obviously loved him and he loved the microphone, but I think people wanted to hear that quiet, real sounding music. People are ready for something that's essentially truthful. You know, and that people crave that. And Dad was the first one to provide that in music. Because before then, people were singing at the piano, sort of silly songs with silly lyrics. And then when Dad came along, there were all these unbelievable lyricists as well. Not only do you have a guy who wants to focus on the words, but then you've got these amazing words to focus on. So it was a really harmonious connection.
One of the key things that Paul Whiteman also deserves credit for is the idea of giving real artistic space and creative space and actual physical space on a recording to the band vocalists. So you have to give a lot of credit to Paul Whiteman for allowing that to happen, and to Bill Challis for actually working out the nuts and bolts of how that would happen, working out how a singer would fit musically into a band.
Tain't so, honey, tain't so. Tomorrow will bring something good, I know, tain't so. I mean, it just ain't so. Makes no difference what your problem may be. Just look up, brother, and I'm sure you will see. Tain't so, honey, tain't so. The devil said yes, but the Lord said no. Tain't so, honey, tain't so.
Will Friedwald again.
There was a quote from Louis Armstrong in reference to Bix Beiderbecke, where he said that he and Bix were working on the same thing. And it's very interesting because it obviously means that he and Bix were both working out, you know, how to play jazz trumpet, how to solo on the trumpet in a you know, brilliant, spectacular, wonderful way. And I always thought that the same quote could be applied also to Bing Crosby. He and Armstrong were working on the same thing in the sense that they were both working on how are you going to apply the techniques of jazz, this new music that came out of New Orleans and was reaching an apogee in Chicago at that point in the mid-1920s, reaching a new maturity, and then in New York, and filtering into big bands, filtering into popular music. How is this music going to affect the way that popular songs are sung? And obviously the two guys who were most working on that were Louis Armstrong and Bing Crosby.
Louis was huge in his life. He also sang a lot with Ella and Rosie Clooney and Pearl Bailey. So the jazz element in his early days was absorbed by him. And he worked with a lot of black musicians at a time when there wasn't a lot of integration musically. And he would either insist on working with them and performing with them if it was possible, or if not, he'd just go jam with them in Harlem, with the Mills brothers and people like that. So the jazz influence was huge for him. And of course, Louis was not only a very big musical influence, but I think just a really beloved friend.
With the segregation in America at that time, jazz musicians, black and white, came up with everything totally different, like Louis Armstrong's scat and Bing Crosby's scat. Louis Armstrong's scat swung more because that was the black rhythm. Bing Crosby's scat, as done with the Rhythm Boys, was very similar to Bix Beiderbecke because Bix Beiderbecke's timing was ba ba doo 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 ba doo 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 wa da boo ba doo 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 doo. You see? So etc. You see, so that's the style, white style.
Whereas Louis was singing much more.
Come on down to that dance. They call it heebie jeebies dance. Sweet mama, papa got to do the heebie jeebies dance.
Everybody thinks scat began with Louis Armstrong dropping the lead sheet for heebie jeebies, but in fact, quite a bit before that, there'd been a singer called Cliff Edwards, also known as Ukulele Ike, who was quite a master of nonsense syllables.
He had great natural talent, same as Bing Crosby had, a great natural gift. But what he had was an incredible range. He could sing in falsetto, and he would sing like a bird. He would roll his eyes and as part of his scat vocal, which is very, very charming.
I'm singing in the rain, just singing in the rain. What a glorious feeling, I'm happy again. I'm laughing at clouds so dark up above. The sun's in my heart and I'm ready for love.
When the microphone happened, people like Cliff Edwards were doing vaudeville. They were doing different towns every week. He was earning $4,000 a week in 1925 and also losing it. He had an act which was comedy and song, and he played his ukulele. When the microphone came along, he also showed his tender side, singing ballads and stuff, because they could do, you see. He wasn't having to do the roustabout vocals, which he did on the stage. One of the things about Cliff Edwards, it seems to me, is that we might know his work from his later appearances on the soundtrack of Disney films. I mean, he was the voice of Jiminy Cricket.
He was Jiminy Cricket. He was never credited. But if you consider, I think about 1921, 22, Cliff Edwards was recording with Lads Black Aces. Now, on that, a lot of people for many years, I think, believed that he was playing a kazoo or Coleman paper or something, but the people weren't quite ready for his vocal talents, his scat vocalising, and he sang like an instrument. This, of course, is years before other people did it.
¶¶
So when we hear Bing in his early recordings with the Paul Whiteman Orchestra with the Rhythm Boys, actually a lot of their scat material is probably more likely drawn from somebody like Cliff Edwards than it is the black singers like Louis Armstrong.
Yeah, I mean, if you take the Rhythm Boys, now, I always think that the Rhythm Boys, Paul Whiteman was a superb businessman and by all accounts an extremely fair guy to work for. And I think that the guys he had arranging tunes were some of the finest musicians of the time, as with the musicians in the orchestra. Now, if you listen to the phrasing of the Rhythm Boys, you'll find that it ties in with the rhythms of the day. Now, if you think of 1926, 1927, everything is vo-di-o-di-o. Vo-di-o-di-o-di-o-di-do-do-do. The songs were like that. And the Rhythm Boys, all their phrasing is rud do 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 dub do 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 la 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 da do do, that kind of thing. So it's all the same thing.
Crosby and the Rhythm Boys were laid off by Paul Whiteman after the 1929 Wall Street crash. The Depression hit every sphere of American life, and although it initially seemed unscathed, Hollywood was ultimately no exception. Gary Giddens.
Paramount was, of all the major studios, was the most in trouble. And there's no question that the enormous, unexpected success of Crosby put them back in the black, especially after they lost, because of the censors, Mae West and Marlena Dietrich and Maurice Chevalier, who were their three biggest box office celebrities during the pre-code period. And it became, in a sense, the Crosby studio. And then Jack Capp got what everybody else thought was this insane idea of starting a new record company at the very depth of the Depression, using Crosby sort of as his guarantee, because Bing agreed to go wherever Jack went. With Ted Lewis from England, they managed to launch the American version of Decca. And, of course, Cap understood Depression economics and started offering records at half the price that the other labels, three for a dollar at one point.
A clouded moon creeps across a clouded sky, winds of January sigh and moan. And yet it's you, I can see a sky of blue. Dear, the miracle is due to you, just you. It's June in January, because I'm in love.
With Crosby, Hollywood's silver lining in the clouds of the Depression, the age of the superstar crooner had well and truly arrived. Naturally, others sought to take his crown. Will Friedwald.
There was a pop song in 1931, I believe, about the three biggest singers on the radio, and they were Bing Crosby, Russ Colombo, and Rudy Valley. The song was Crosby, Colombo, and Valley. And Russ Colombo was a very big star in the early 1930s, and he definitely patterned himself after Bing Crosby. He was positioned as Bing Crosby's rival.
Who we to break the chains that bind me? I need no shackles to remind me. I'm just a prisoner.
Almost everything he did were ballads, and he doesn't have the same sort of depth of conviction that Crosby has, and he can't do the jazz things that Crosby could do. He can't swing like Crosby. He doesn't really have the full depth, and had he lived longer, there's every reason to believe that Columbo might have developed as well into that area. I mean, he probably would have had to. He couldn't have kept doing the same thing and still been popular.
Good night, my love, the tired old
I wanted to go on to another point, Gary, which is really this moment when Rudy Valley appears on the scene. And suddenly there's a very different style of singing, and it turned Bing's head. It actually shook him. I mean, you don't see many examples of Bing having an influence that isn't absorbed and turned into something entirely positive. But I think this was an influence that, for a very short time at any rate, was rather negative on him.
Well, he had a sort of prim moral sense about music in a way, and I think that Rudy Vallee really affected his sensibility, and especially the incredible success he had. There was just something so prissy, and the nasality of his style, and just the incredible arrogance with which he presented himself.
So for the present, dear, we'll have to part. Sleep tight, my love.
You know, it sort of reminded me of later when he was asked to tour during World War II, and he went to Britain and he went to France, and they offered him a commission, you know, captain major or something, and he wouldn't even hear of it. He couldn't believe that Glenn Miller would do that. He thought it was insulting to all those people who actually put their lives on the line to take a title like that. And I think in some ways he was offended by the incredible success of Rudy Vallee, who you know, turned out to be a very charming comic actor in the Preston Sturges movies, but was just a dreadful musician. I mean, my goodness. And of course, his celebrity lasted very, very short time. And he became so associated with crooning that for several years, Crosby found himself constantly being grouped with Russ Colombo and Rudy Vallee, when in fact Bing was the only one who had really listened to jazz, who could swing, who could do all kinds of numbers, and who had that, you know, great musicality that did survive the decades. I love Artie Shaw's line. He said to me, "The first thing you have to understand about Bing Crosby is that he was the first hip white person born in America." Crosby was the guy who took that rhythm from Louis Armstrong and others, Duke Ellington, Ethel Waters, and took it into the white mainstream. And he sort of set a standard that a lot of the other singers would have to rely on.
Louis Armstrong said that Bing's voice was like gold being poured out of a cup. And that gold continued to flow up until his death in 1977. In the next program, I'll be talking with those who worked with him right up to the end.
Can you imagine if you were rehearsing with Bing Crosby, what you'd expect it to be like?
Never in my life did I think I was going to record with Bing Crosby.
I phoned Bing, and he said, "Hi, Ken." He said, "What's doing?" And I said, "Well, I've got an idea for a duet album." He said, "Who would that be with?" "Fred Astaire." And he says, "Okay, count me in."
If you're heading for a sunny honeymoon, learn to croon.